Okay, welcome back everybody and happy Halloween. And already been asked a couple of times when the tests will be ready. They have been graded. They will be passed back and available in lab this week. Recommend you check over your score, make sure the machine added it up correctly. And any questions you have with the exam, bring your questions to your TAs or ultimately bring them to me. I will say that one question, it was either the last one or the one before last, 94% of the class got it wrong. So I'll probably revisit it in a future lecture. Okay, we're going straight back into the material. If you remember, we are discussing the third dimension, the three-dimensional form of the landscape. And so far we've looked at it primarily cartographically or cartometrically. What I'd like to do today is to try and present more of some sort of general purpose background on topography and just what it is that we want to interpret in those contours on the maps. And as we'll see, the patterns of three-dimensional form of the landscape on maps is very much determined by the forces and the forms that are present, the forces of erosion and deposition that have changed the shape of the Earth. And they do it in very predictable ways, and I hope to at least cover some of them today, enough to sort of instill in you a desire to go in and try and figure out what the bigger picture is here. Okay, so we're going to be talking about topographic features on maps. And by this I mean big scale features, mountains, valleys, and so on. Okay, just to review what we've covered so far. We've covered the contour interval, the index contours, and so on. I've said this for the last three lectures. You should be getting it by now. Last time we added the rule of V's, which allowed us to see which way water is moving on the landscape. And we started looking at the difference between concave and convex slopes. We noticed that slopes have shape, they have orientation and gradient, and basically the more contours we see on the map, the steeper the topography. And we'll see how that comes into play as we start looking at different landscapes today. We can get absolute information from contours in terms of actual elevations, but then we can also establish gradients and directions of gradients. And we saw that steepness or slope in the topography has two aspects. One is the actual value of the steepness, and the other one is the direction. And the direction, the quantity of the steepness changes, obviously, as we change direction. If we're on a hill slope, that's downhill, and that's uphill, and those two are very different measures. We've seen that the pattern of contours on maps requires interpretation. Basically, it means looking at those lines on the map and the elevation values that they contain, and then using that to conjure up in your own mind exactly what's here. But if we know a little bit about landforms and how they're laid out on the landscape, it's going to help us in the interpretation. I'll go over some of the different landforms today. So what I've got today is really a kind of compressed class in physical geography and geomorphology. Geomorphology studies the shape of the land surface and how it changes over time. And geomorphology as a discipline has a subfield called geomorphometry, which actually measures the size and shape of these features and tries to quantify them. And generally speaking, when we get into geomorphology, we're continuously seeing this sort of, say it's double-edged sword in some respects. One is that we have processes underway in the landscape, such as heavy rainfall or glacial erosion or wind deposition, and that ultimately those are resulting in form. Often we can't see the process because it takes place relatively slowly, perhaps over months, years, decades, millennia, but we can only try and guess what's happening by looking at the form of the landscape. Very few things in the landscape happen very quickly. Tsunami deposits, landslides, volcanic eruptions are exceptions. They happen relatively quickly. But most things in the landscape happen very slowly, and the forms are built up over millennia. So it takes a long time for the processes to take place. So if we're going to think generally about the landscape and how it's formed, I'll set up this sort of tension, a dynamic tension, if you like. We've got two things taking place at the same time. Erosion is trying to break down and remove the surface materials, what's already there on the landscape, and mechanical forces like gravity or forces like moving water are major agents in this erosive process, and the processes can be very fast or they can be very slow. Deposition takes material that from one location to another, so it redeposits it. So we're both continuously moving away the material that's being eroded, and then often putting that, just simply putting it somewhere else. So within a single stream network, for example, we're eroding material from the headwaters of the upper reaches of the stream, cutting away the landscape. That's what's making those notches in the V's. But that material that's being eroded, the rock and the sand and so on, finds its way down into the lower reaches of the stream where it takes on other forms, sand and gravel bars, levees, and so on. So some of the forces we're contending with, some of them are a little surprising. Chemical actions are much more apparent than you might think, and we'll look at one solution that's extremely common today. Mechanical forces, I often say that gravity always wins in the end on any landscape. Eventually everything will fall down. Gravity, an important element, and it gives us some directionality to movement within the landscape. Water, very erosive and very depositional, strong depositional force within the landscape. So even in the driest landscapes, moving water is still one of the most important shaping elements within the landscape. And wind and many others, but we're only going to go over a few of these today. So each of these is going to create distinctive landforms. This is a term we use in geomorphology to describe a particular form on the landscape that's been produced by a particular process. We often talk about this in the abstract, the terrain skeleton. This work actually goes back over 100 years, but it was formalized in the 1960s by a guy called William Warrants. So we call this the Warrants Network. And within topography, we can divide any given part of the landscape up into passes or saddle points, peaks, ridges, basins, streams, and enclosed pits or depressions in the landscape. And the lines that connect these together very much trace out what you might call the framework or the skeleton of the landscape, that not much is happening geomorphological or geomorphometrically inside one of these things. All the action is on the edges. So ridge lines form break lines, for example, between watersheds and valleys. So some of the terms I'm going to be using today, here they are. We've used some of these already. A peak, simply a summit. A high point, it can be local or global on the landscape. A pit's the opposite. It's a depression. It's the bottom of the depression in the landscape. We're going to talk about ridges and spurs today. Scarp and scree are erosive forces in the landscape, mostly due to gravity, where material simply falls down off of the landscape. I'll point out some scree slopes today. Drainage features, in particular the channel, the part of the stream network that has moving water within it at some time. Those are very important, obviously, for erosion and deposition. We'll briefly talk about inflection points. Saddles, I'll go over those. We've mentioned them briefly so far. We'll go over them again. And this whole idea of basins and watersheds we'll see in some depth. Okay, so what I've got for much of this lecture is simply a slideshow in which I'm going to show you some of these features, and then we'll talk about what forms they're going to leave on the landscape. So here I have, this is Glacial Peak Washington, and you can see that this is obviously high elevations. Okay, so this is up at the levels where snow is probably going to exist perhaps year-round. When snow exists and doesn't melt, we say it accumulates. And when it accumulates and compacts, it becomes ice. And ice is a very, very powerful force in sculpting the environment. So this is a mountain peak, a single peak here. And we've got a secondary peak here. We often call this the false summit. If you're into climbing, very often you'll arrive at that false summit, wholly believing you're about to plant your flag on the top, and you go, uh-oh, another 400 meters to go. Here we've got bodies of ice, and you notice that those fall into rivers. So here we have ridges dividing each of the little sort of ice rivers, one to the next. These are glaciers. And typically we're losing elevation very quickly. These are very pointed summits. They radiate out in each of the directions. But because of the nature of sunlight in the northern hemisphere, typically we get the north side, which has the most ice and the most erosive force on it. Okay, so glacial erosion. Glaciers are around during active periods of glaciation. We're at a kind of a bit of a glacial minimum right now, and we're certainly seeing it getting worse and worse as many of the glaciers are beginning to melt worldwide. If we just back up several thousands of years, we enter an ice age in which much of the landmass, especially of the northern hemisphere, was very much shaped by glaciation. So even though Yosemite Valley today looks like this beautiful, idyllic, unspoiled landscape, if we back up to the last glacial maximum, this would have been full from side to side with a huge glacier, full of ice. Okay? Moving ice has immense power because it's got an enormous amount of gravity behind it. It's going downhill. It's cold, so it can actually freeze blocks onto the surface of the ice and then drag them along, scraping off the hillside. It's so erosive that you end up with this typical U-shaped valley after glaciation. So all the material down here has been removed, and we've got these incredible vertical faces, some of them famous, like El Capitan, and so on, within Yosemite Valley. And then you can see that most of the material has been removed here. We've got this, what's called dislocated drainage. We no longer have the nice, simple pattern of streams dropping down into the valley. Here they just come out as if at the former level, because they used to just flow onto the ice. Now the ice is gone, they just plunge down to the bottom of the bottom. And, you know, John Muir wrote about this a long time ago, the incredible nature of Yosemite's falls. Okay, let's think of other depressions within the landscape. The so-called U-shaped valleys are going to be a clear sign that glaciation has taken place. Displaced drainage is a clear sign. But one of the most common means by which erosion takes place in the landscape that gives it a distinct form is on limestone landscapes. Okay? Enormous proportion of the Earth's surface is on limestone. Thank goodness it locks up an enormous amount of carbon in those rocks, which is not available for release into the atmosphere. So you might say, you know, creation of new limestone regions is good for the planet. Limestone regions have extremely common features that recur worldwide. So you'll find the same features occurring in parts of Britain, all over the United States, in Kentucky, in Central America. Over and over again, you've seen these same features reproduced. The type of landscape we named for the region where it was first described, which is a region called karst. It's actually now follows pretty much extreme eastern part of Italy and down through Slovenia into Croatia. That area was where this type of landscape was first described. In Croatian, they leave out the A, they just call it karst. So this is, I took this picture when I was visiting there. This is a place called Skjepcenske Jami. Jami just means cave in Slovenia, where you get all these very, very characteristic limestone landscape features. What is the characteristic of limestone? Well, it's chalk, basically. It's very, very soft. And when rain falls on the landscape and interacts with plant matter, it turns slightly acidic. When you put an acid on chalk, it begins to dissolve it, and it can do it very quickly indeed. Typically, what happens in one of these limestone landscapes is that the water immediately finds all the weak spots and disappears underground, and then starts creating enormous underground caves. This is Skjepcenske Jami. There's about a 10-kilometer trail you can hike deep underground the entire length of this river. You see the entire river that's disappeared underground roaring down there in the distance, usually pitch dark. We only turn the pictures, the camera, the lights on for the pictures. So a very impressive place. But what do we see on the surface when we've got chemical dilution taking place underneath? Well, we see things like this. This is a very classic piece of karst landscape called a dolina. Okay, you might think it's just a soccer field, there's the goalposts. But this is actually a depression in the landscape. It looks like this from above, where there's a sinkhole here, just a crack in the limestone where water can go underground. And what happens is all the sediments begin to collect in here, and usually at the very top you get a layer of clay. And that clay serves to sort of like, it's like putting a cork in a bottle. It locks up the hole. It stops water getting down through. It sits on the surface. So usually it's fairly fertile. It's damp year-round. This would be not a great place to play soccer in the winter. Be a bit squishy. And then typically it begins to become depressed like this and just drops further and further. This is what's happening here. Well, deep underneath this, why I put this picture here, deep underneath the landscape, the rock here, are these caves. Obviously, if we're slowly eroding holes further and further down into the landscape, what's going to happen eventually? Well, the top's going to collapse, the top of the cave's going to collapse, and we're going to get a hole that goes deep down into the landscape. At the bottom of the hole is going to be a river, probably, moving water. Once it's collapsed, we call it a depression or a sinkhole in limestone topography. Okay, so it's not a very good picture. I apologize for that. Generally speaking, they look pretty awful in the middle because they're a result of collapse. And we see these, we've now learned that these hatch marks pointing downwards are a good example of what happens. So we've got a depression here following three contours. Notice that once water goes down this hole, it's got nowhere to go. Okay, so often you get puddles and lakes and water bodies forming in the bottom of them, or a marsh. Then when the water does flow away in this little streamlet here, it just disappears. These are called disappearing streams, and they sometimes emerge. In the case of Schiavonazzo, it emerges about 15 to 20 kilometers away on the border with Italy. We have lots of limestone regions in the United States. One of the better known is parts of Florida. So here's an enormous sinkhole. These areas get developed. This is part of a major city here. These are houses and shops and so on, a parking lot. And you'll see these in the news occasionally. It's an enormous sinkhole suddenly opened up, usually after a rainstorm. Bang! The roof of a subterranean cave has collapsed, and now we've got this enormous hole in the ground. Okay, try getting building insurance on that property. Okay, a little change of pace. Here we are in up on Figueroa Mountain Road, up by Figueroa Mountain. If you want to go and see some landscape, there actually is some there over the mountains, you know. The UCSB campus is not just this little area here. The UCSB owns the reserve system, UC as a whole owns an incomplete reserve system. One of the sites managed by UCSB is the Sedgwick Preserve, which is over across the first mountain range by Figueroa Mountain. And the university owns an entire watershed there where they do all sorts of environmental and botanical research. This is actually just outside the property for that, but it's a good example of a saddle point. Okay, so here we are in, notice the vegetation type, California coastal savanna, oak savanna. So the primary tree species is oak, disappearing oak these days because we have things like sudden oak death syndrome taking place and leading to loss of some trees. Grasslands, sedges, small bushes, creosote, some chaparral. But just take a look at what happens for this point within the landscape. If we came up this valley here, there's actually a ancient Shumash site right here. If you come up and go over that lip, we are going up a valley, we come over to a top, and we go down again. If I start up here on the road and hike down, I go down here to the bottom, this little road here, and then I have to hike up again. So in two opposite directions, if I approach a 90 degree difference, I'm either at a peak or a pit, depending upon the direction you approach the landscape. We call this a saddle point because it looks like a saddle. When you put the saddle astride the horse, this fits in the arch of the horse's back. So we shape the saddle accordingly, otherwise we'd slip off. And then we put our legs across the horse in the other direction, so we've reached a high point and a low point when we sit in the base of a saddle. Here's one in the landscape. The giveaway sign in the contours that we're passing a saddle is we've got a peak here, a peak here. If we come in this direction, we reach a peak here. If we come in this direction, we're at a trough. So you've got this sort of big X sign that's being told to you by the topography. If you look at the contours and you see this giveaway X sign in the contours, chances are you're looking at a saddle. Okay, watershed. What is a watershed? Well, if we simply follow, go to a water outlet source, like this one. This is where Arroyo Burro Creek reaches the ocean, at Hendry's Beach, right nearby here, where campus is over here. If we follow the stream upwards to the mountains, we realize that we can draw a finite line around all the area that's going to drain into that one creek. It might have tributaries in the upper regions, and in fact it actually does, but we can draw a definitive line around Arroyo Burro Creek and separate it from Mission Creek, the one that comes out here in downtown Santa Barbara, the one that's right next to it. Okay. The area that drains into a single outlet point is called a watershed, and we often talk about subcomponents of it. Those are quite significant. Actually, these two are simply showing you stream sampling sites from the LTER. That's our long-term ecological research station here at UCSB, which is studying the Santa Barbara Channel and the kelp forests within it. But some interesting aspects, the Arroyo Burro Creek watershed actually has quite a lot of horse farms in it and a lot of agriculture, and that often leads to sources of contamination such as E. coli finding its way into the water. I often walk my dog down here on the beach on the weekends, and right after a major storm event, you can see the effluent coming out. You can just see the bad stuff going into the water. Not a good place to surf. Interesting enough, this creek used to drain out here into... Mission Creek actually used to drain out through Arroyo Burro. So if you ever drive up Las Positas towards, say, Hollister from Hendry's Beach, you'll notice that the valley, which is a regular river valley, is very much deeper, and the sides much steeper than you would think they would be for the size of Arroyo Burro Creek, which is pretty tiny. And that's because all of Mission Creek used to itself flow down this way, but it got shifted by some major earthquake events in the past. Okay, let's get to more simple features. Hills. Everybody thinks they know what a hill is, but they vary quite a bit. Often we have a simple peak. We have different gradients in different directions. When we look at a hill from a distance and we can see a break line here, that's the furthest point you can see on the hillside. We call this the ridge line. So you can trace the ridge line, fairly clearly see the ridge line tracing the feature here. There are lots of reasons why you end up with very regularly shaped hills, often for different reasons. In these both cases, they're depositional features. In other words, stuff has been eroded elsewhere in the landscape and it's being deposited here. In this case, we've got dunes. We've got a very large dune field just up north of Vandenberg Air Force Base, the Guadalupe Dunes up, they're quite famous up north of here. Now that's simply wind material that's been pulled out for different sources, from stream beds, from the ocean, and been blown up into dunes that then start to move. If they move their way into a location where they've got slightly more water, they'll become permanent, they'll get a soil layer over the top, and they'll be fixed in place. So very often things like the sandhills in North Dakota, those are fixed in place dunes that date back to the end of the last ice age. More about that in just a minute. Here's one from Great Britain that's a lot more distinctive. It's got a very unique form. The rest of the surrounding countryside looks pretty much flat. And you'd almost begin to suspect that human beings built this because it looks so regular. But no, this was where a single rock was sticking up when the ice sheet was moving over the top of it. And that one rock attracted all of the stuff that was being dragged by the glacier, piled up and piled up over the time of the ice sheet movement, and then when the ice melted, it simply left it here as a feature called a drumlin. And there are whole areas of the world in glaciated regions, usually on flatlands beyond the glaciated regions, that are covered in these drumlin fields. There are thousands and thousands of these. They call them swarms because there are so many of them together. So often a rolling hills landscape is a glacial depositional feature, like this drumlin, or an aeolian depositional feature, like a dune. Aeolian simply being blown by the wind. Okay, ridges and ridge lines are very distinctive because they determine our line of sight within the landscape. So they're very much going to affect navigation. They can be fickle because you can just move a few feet in either direction, and the look of the ridgeline changes, the shape of the ridgeline might change. But generally speaking, they're always a local high point. So if you can imagine like this chap here, who's just hiked up or is just on the way to hike up to that peak, that's obviously the easiest way to get to the peak is to follow the ridgeline. It's a much easier walk than, say, going up this way or going up that way, which is very much steeper. So a ridgeline is both a definitive feature, although it's a little bit ambiguous as to what it actually is. It's a point where the gradient changes direction. Here it's down on this side, down on that side. Made up of blocky boulders, but nevertheless there it is. So we begin to see ridgelines here, and we see other ridgelines coming off of them. If the ridgelines go down into the lower topography, we call these spurs. So spurs are sort of half a ridgeline that go from the mountaintops, the actual ridgeline itself, down into lower elevations. Spurs are kind of unique. If here we're just simply standing at a point, we're looking down a small stream valley in probably fairly soft terrain. This could be anywhere nearby. I mean, we've got a lot of this kind of topography here. And you notice that what happens is, imagine we start here and we're looking over at the landscape. We've got a spur coming down this way. And you see the stream looping around it here. And then we see a spur coming down from the other side. So the stream is going side to side, and we've got interlocking spurs. The spurs sort of mesh like that and make this characteristic landform. If we looked at it on the contour maps, we'd see spur, valley. Valley because the streams are following the law of V's. They're facing uphill. Okay. This is quite clearly a spur landscape. We've got some high ground at the top. We've got valleys coming down and forming regions here, and water outlet at the bottom. We see the same sort of interlocking spur characteristic that you might find anywhere else. Anybody know where that is? It's on Mars. Okay. So this is one of the chief ways that we argue that there must have been some kind of water or some kind of liquid that shaped the surface of Mars at some point in its history. We can argue, because we know about landforms on Earth, what they look like on Earth, we can argue that the same types of landforms must exist also on Mars. Okay, continuing my slideshow, this is a place I visited 4 or 5 years ago now, and this is a landscape that's dominated by wind. So this is an erosive landscape. It's got very loose surface material. It's actually the bottom of an old ancient inland sea. So it's layers and layers of very loose sandstone. And the one force that's playing in here is wind. You go here, the wind's blowing continuously. It's picking up the sand. You can feel it. You know, grit gets into your sandwiches continuously in this location. This is called an aeolian or wind-eroded desert landscape. And you'll notice that anything solid, like a piece of rock that's more resistant than its neighboring rock, or isolated things in the landscape, just get deposited on the surface. They just get left as bare rock. And eventually these become what are called Hamada desert, or it's hard rock desert where all the loose material has been blown away. You notice that you can almost see the old layers of the lake beds or the ocean beds up here. They've been eroded away, but they survive as remnants. We have here a mesa, which is the Spanish word table. It simply means it's a feature that is high, but it's wider than it has height. And then we have a butte, which is one that's higher than it is wide. Otherwise, it's the same kind of feature. And the reason I was here in Wadi Hattan, which is being excavated by Phil Gingrich, who's a paleontologist at the University of Michigan, is because of this. This is an intact skeleton of an ancient whale that lived in this landscape. Because of the erosion, these are literally falling out of the side of the hillside. And it's been determined that these whales were quite remarkable because they represent the stage of evolution when whales had just returned to the sea after being a land mammal. It's pretty incredible to think that, but they actually still had arms and legs, these whales. And you get all sorts of amazing landscapes that develop when you have aeolian erosion, when you've got wind forcing the landscape. I mean, they called that the camel in the location. It very much looks like it. Here you can see some of the ablative processes. So these holes and pock marks are coming from where the sand is actually being... It's like being sandblasted. When you get a big windstorm here, it's just like taking a sandblaster and blasting away at the surface of the rock. Where does all that material go? Well, let's start with the most we ever came up with, and that is at the end of the last glacial maximum. We had enormous proportions of the continents had been pushed around, got stuff that gets continuously eroded down, getting smaller and smaller particles. It's usually silts, gravels, clays to some extent. When the glaciers melt and move away and dump it all on the landscape, we don't have any vegetation in place yet, no soil to keep it down. So what happens when the winds start to blow and the storms come? It just gets picked up and moves on a scale unprecedented. I mean, you think that the 1930s, 20s and 30s dust storms were significant events. These were nothing compared to what happened after the last glacial maximum. How can I say that? Well, in some cases, deposits of material from this era represent geological strata that might be, you know, up to 100 meters thick on the landscape, just tons and tons and tons of stuff pulled off. China has the largest region in the world of these deposits. They're called loess. That's wind-blown, unconsolidated silt and sands and gravels. This entire region in central China here is an area of this loess plateau. This is what it looks like from above. You can see that it's pretty much uniform. It's just basically just, you know, 100 meters of stuff dumped on the landscape that's now being eroded by the river systems as they cut down into it, forming very distinctive types of landscapes. But it's not just China that has this. We have loess hills in the state of Iowa. This is pretty much what they look like. They might look like sand hills. They look like remnants of a previous erosional level that just is being slowly eroded away bit by bit. The ultimate sand pit, you might say. Okay, let's move into something that's a little, perhaps a little bit more familiar and close to home. If we go to Clay County, Minnesota, here we have a very flat landscape. This is a former lake bottom landscape, former ocean bottom landscape. And the soils are very clay. Clay soils are very fine particles that can bond together tightly so they don't allow water to flow through. So they form a very different type of landscape. When they dry out in the summer, it's kind of like concrete. I remember doing some work on my old house when I used to live here in Goleta. And, you know, I try to pick and broke that, try to shovel and broke that. In the end, I put my one-inch drill bit on to make a hole in this clay. It's so solid when it gets dry. So here we've got a standard drainage feature. Because it's so flat, this feature kind of meanders around. So it's slowly losing elevation. There's not a heck of a lot of topography in this landscape. The vegetation type here, this is one of the last surviving pieces of natural prairie cover. There are very few of them left in the United States because most of the land in the Great Plains has been converted to soybeans, corn, and other agricultural crops. Okay, so I mentioned moving water, and moving water is indeed one of the principal means by which stuff gets moved around in the landscape and by which most erosion takes place. Here we see a stream cutting through these up into the landscape. We know it's a small stream, so it's not shown as a very large feature. We can see because it's up around 2,600 feet, it's at some high elevations, and it's crossing contours all the time. Look, one there, one there, one there, one there, one there, one there. So it's losing elevation very quickly. So it might look like something like this. This is in a glaciated region, very cold. We've got a stream that starts up here. It has its headwaters in this saddle point up here. It's obviously snow melt fed, so it may not run for much of the year, but come the spring, the snow starts to melt, the stream begins to get very lively, and it cuts this notch or V-shaped valley into the landscape, and it's continuously eroding that down. If we look at the profile, it loses much of the elevation of its entire length in the first few kilometers. So it plunges down and then steadies out to a slower gradient along the course of the river. Often we get these branching structures taking place with rivers like this. So we've got tributaries that converge onto a single point, and we've got other features that are associated with these landscapes. Now, ultimately, water has to emerge from somewhere. It can have a source that might be a lake. It can suddenly emerge from underground if you're in a karstic limestone landscape. But ultimately, it's going to emerge from the subsurface at a particular point. So that'll often be shown as the furthest-most point on the stream as it's marked on the landscape. So here we're following the law of V's. We've reached a saddle point here. We're at the top. So it's not going to. There's no more water coming above that point. It's got to be the source. And the first few feet of the stream, it's not really much of a stream. You could jump across it quite easily. A lot of these up here in the mountains just above us. So it's sometimes called a draw, a gully, or a spring. Depends where you are in the country. They use different terms. Now, streams very quickly reach this point, the confluence, where two streams join together. And when two streams join, because of the power laws, you get much more erosive power when you've got more water moving down the stream. So as streams concentrate their energy, they become much more like engines that are exerting power on the landscape. We often use what are called stream order systems to gauge these and quantify them. So one of those is called the Strela stream order, which is named after Arthur Strela, a famous geomorphologist who worked at Columbia University and actually retired here in Santa Barbara, lived up on the Riviera for many years. He simply said, if you follow any stream to its furthestmost point, its spring, and you call that a one, that's an order one stream. And any time two streams of the same order meet, you increase the order by one. So two ones make a two, two twos converge, you get a three, two threes converge, you get a four, and so on. There are very few stream systems in the world that go up over 12, 13, 14, 15. Mostly, by the time you get to that point, you've reached the ocean. So this is a meaningful way of describing the landscape. Notice that as we go to the lower order streams, we would think of higher gradients, much more erosive power in the upper branches and more depositional power in the lower branches. Okay. Back in the work of William Morris Davis, this was formalized as a model. He called it the lifetime model of a stream. So up in the uppermost reaches here, we get erosion dominating over deposition. So we're getting more cutting away of the landscape. He called this a youthful stream. So it's cutting a deep notch, V shape into the landscape, getting fairly steep gullies. You see these in the mountains up here all the time. When we get down to the middle ranges of the stream, we begin to reach an area where the stream has eroded a floodplain. So the stream at different times of the year during flood will hop out of these banks and will meander or go across or fill this area between the two hill slopes. Generally speaking, when you get a flood and the water suddenly bursts out of its banks, it immediately slows down. When it slows down, all the stuff that's in suspension in the river drops, and that's where it's going to get left on the landscape. Over millennia, this builds up, and we get these alluvial channels building up along the stream beds. So it's shown here as an actual geological layer. These can be sometimes, you know, tens, twenties, thirties of meters in size. When we get to the lower parts of the river, when it's reaching what's called its base level, it's getting nearer and nearer to the ocean. It obviously can't go below the level of the ocean, otherwise water would flow back into the stream. So it has to remain above the level of the ocean. But we've got less and less energy for erosion and more for deposition. So the stream begins to meander all over the place, causing a very slow but sure path through the entire width of the flood channel. It's kind of looking for the path of least resistance through the environment. Very little erosion taking place. Mostly we're just moving sediment at low speed down towards the ocean. But we do get very characteristic distinctive features that take place in these types of streams. I'll go over some of them in just a minute. Okay. Very important to understanding rivers is the idea of meanders. So there have been all sorts of theories about why they form. Basically, it doesn't take a genius to see that any stream flowing in a straight line is either going to be subject to Coriolis force or it's going to hit a boulder or something that's going to divert it. And once it's diverted, diversions or meanders become self-sustaining because of a rather simple property. Let's start over on this end side. If we've got a stream that's beginning to meander, the faster flow of the water is on the outside of the channels. You know, if you doubt this, just try, if you've been roller skating, you've got a bunch of people holding hands together, and you go around a corner, and the guy in the middle is barely going like this to keep up, and the guy at the end is about to fly off. So we always go faster on the outsides, and the effect here is that the faster flow has the most erosive power, but in the places where we're going slowest, like around the inside of these scars, the water slows down, so any suspended sediment begins to drop out as sandbanks. So if we're looking at a stream, as you crossed over it, you'd expect to see a steep bank on the outside of the meander where the stream is actively cutting into the landscape. And you'd expect to see like mud flats or sandbars appearing on the slower side, the inside of the meander. Well, it doesn't take a genius to see that if you do this over time, it makes the sort of sinuous pattern of the landscape of the meanders intensify over time, and eventually you see that this difference here between two erosive parts of the system are going to simply cut through. So we're going to cut through the meander here. We get the stream is going to take a diversion and go off down the new channel and leave this little loop in isolation. Eventually it too will silt up and it'll leave this bizarre thing here called an oxbow lake. Now, these are all over the deep south. They're called bayous down there. You know? And then we've got this new pattern or new path that the river's going to take. Imagine that this happens over millions or thousands of years. You've slowly got this erosive force with the river moving side to side across the stream belt, flattening the floodplain and moving the channel all over the place. What are these going to look like on the map? Well, Oxbow Lake is going to be an enclosed water body. Eventually, it's got no supply of water, so it's going to dry up, or it's going to become a swamp or a wetland. We're going to get, generally speaking, flat surroundings. We're going to get steeper sides on the outside, and so on. So let's look at some. Let's look at an area here. Not exactly sure where this is, but it doesn't matter. We've actually got one labeled here as a meander scar, and you can see that this stream that now goes off down this way, at some time in the past, must have come around here. This is just marked as an ephemeral pond right now. But it must have been a lake for a while, and before that it was the actual stream bed of the river itself. We've got another one here, where this river must have come around here, and then that meander got cut off like this one, and it moved off and took that. Okay, if you really want to look at it hard, you can look at the actual pattern of the contours and see that, yes indeed, the erosive outside of the bend does have steeper gradients associated with the depositional insides of the bends. When you let a river build up long enough, you built this characteristic pattern where as a river gets slower and slower, carries more and more material, think of the muddy Mississippi down there by New Orleans, just a big brown blob as it's moving along, all full of mud. Anytime that it does flood, it's going to quickly flow over its embankments and then dissipate. So it's going to drop all the material that's being held in sediment because the water's moving faster. And the place where it's going to drop all that sediment is immediately on its own embankments. So over time, a depositional stream will actually build up its own banks to the extent that the river can actually become higher than the surrounding landscape. I still remember having breakfast in a hotel in Savannah. I was at a meeting there once, which was right down on the river floodplain, and it looked out at the levees. And while I was sitting there eating my breakfast, this huge ocean freighter comes sailing by, but it's not like down there, it's way up there, because the level of the water is actually above where I'm sitting down on the landscape. This is not good if you own property and it's susceptible to flooding, but it is a very characteristic form. So here we've got the Rio Grande down on the Texas border. You can see the levees are really quite substantial on either side. You notice that they're a little bit more built up on the Californian side, on the Texan side than on the Mexican side. Oops, that's because the Mexican side doesn't have any topography marked on it, not because it doesn't exist. So what a levee actually looks like. Here we are on the lower Mississippi. You can see that here the Army Corps of Engineers has come in and done its duty and reinforced the levee and made it higher to try and prevent flooding. But in doing so has given us all sorts of other problems. Here's an area where the river has actually breached the levee and gone out into the flood floodlands beyond it. And the idea is that if you've got a city or some residential areas you want to protect them, you want this, you don't want that. Okay, this whole property that rapidly moving water suddenly loses its ability to carry sediment is also very evident in desert landscapes. So here we are out in Death Valley. Here we've obviously got a lot more topography. You can't see the contours clearly, but it's fairly obvious from the shading here that this is steep, has lots of valleys, and that drainage is going to accumulate up. It has a single outlet point here. Okay? So this little stream system here feeds out into the valley floor here. So here we go down into the playas of Death Valley. What happens over time? Well, if you've got heavily sediment-laden water and a stream that suddenly changes its gradient and its velocity, it's going to deposit the material. If you do this over thousands of years, you build up a regular feature. This is an alluvial fan. And see that, look at the pattern of the contours. They make almost perfect semicircles going outwards, so that not only is this losing gradient, it's doing it in a very uniform way. It's like a cone. It's like the surface of a cone, with the apex of the cone being where the sediment is finding its way out of the mountains. If you've ever driven around out in Death Valley or out in the desert, anywhere in Nevada, you've certainly seen these things. They're all over the place. And the stream channels within them can be over here one year and over here the next year. So they're very unpredictable. Very often wash out roads and flood and so on. This is what an alluvial fan looks like on a topographic map. So here we begin to put all these features together. This is Ennis, Montana. It's a fairly famous one on Cedar Creek, alluvial fan. So here's our outlet point. You notice that as soon as the water finds its way out into the plain, the stream becomes braided, or it goes off into many different channels, but they're all marked with dashed lines, so they're all ephemeral. None of these is going to run water the whole time. It depends on which way the gravity is going at any particular moment. You notice that this has been sectioned, so this is supposedly farmland that can be farmed, although you probably can't rely upon the fact that you can have water available here for irrigation. And again, this is very high elevations, and then suddenly we go down into lower elevations with a very, very regular pattern of the contours becoming more broken up as we get out towards the bottom of the playa, the flatlands at the bottom. Okay, so that's an alluvial fan. They're absolutely distinctive. They're so clear, you can see them on satellite images a mile away. You know, you can pick them up with the landscape very straightforwardly. On the maps, they're a giveaway because of this radial pattern of the contours. It's almost like somebody drew them there. Okay, running out of time, so let's have a little quiz. What is this? I'm not going to ask you anything you haven't just seen. Sorry, didn't hear. It is a topographic map, correct, absolutely correct. What feature is it showing? Let's point out some of the elements here. Lots of lakes, lots of swamps around here, some disjoint. And then we've got a lot of very regularly looking round-shaped hills that all seem to be in the same general direction. Drumlins, yeah, this is a drumlin field. One of the characteristics of drumlins is that they often got the sand got dumped over the existing drainage system, so the drainage becomes what's called dislocated. It just turns into a bunch of swamps and isolated ponds. Well, we didn't guess where, but I'll just keep going here. We've only got a couple of minutes left. We've seen some pictures of these things before. See many contours on that map? Which means it's flat. And it's covered with marsh. So this is a swamp. If I had to guess where, I would guess Florida. Here's some of the giveaways. We've got isolated lakes at very high elevations in mountains. We've got extremely sharp ridges. We've got things actually labeled glacier, I think, on here. So this is part of a glaciated landscape. It's still got some active glaciation, but mostly it's a place where the ice has gone, and we've got this post-glacial landscape, much like Yosemite Valley. Okay, I haven't talked about one of the major forces in shaping the face of the Earth. What's this feature here? It's a quarry, yeah. So it's labeled as quarry on the topographic map, so it doesn't take a genius. But you can see that it's got a surrounding fence around here, that it's got a disturbed landscape. It's in purple, which is the revision layer, which means that it suddenly happened in the landscape. It's only been picked up in the new edition of the map. This is classic open pit mining, where they're just simply dredging off probably, I would guess, coal or copper or zinc or something like that. Notice that we get a lot of spontaneously forming lakes as a result. When you totally take away the drainage, you end up with a mess. Okay, so in a real landscape, we've got all of these features thrown together. We have to pick them apart, and one of the most important clues that we're getting is the topography and the contour lines. But we've got all sorts of other clues. So if you see mine shafts or oil fields or, you know, rivers that disappear underground, there are hints that something more profound is going on here. There are larger scale features that we need to deal with. Okay, so contours and other relief methods can show terrain structure. That's what we're interested in. We can interpret the structure to see what natural and human features are present. I was just reading in the newspaper this morning about the huge deficit of labor in North Dakota because they're opening up more oil and gas fields there. There's a shortage of labor. We suddenly got this oil boom going on in North Dakota during a recession. We looked at the skeleton of the landscape and how it shapes it. Different landscapes have very different features. And there are lots of clues for interpreting where and what. We should be able to identify where we are in the world or what processes are taking place just by where we are. Okay, see you on Wednesday.